listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Because of the pandemic, a lot of people plan on buying at least some, if not all, of their holiday gifts online. That means scammers are ready to pounce. We'll have some tips on how to protect your identity and your pocketbook coming up. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in a challenge to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The case brought by plaintiffs in Texas and attorneys general in 18 Republican-led states claims that the law is unconstitutional. Wisconsin was part of that lawsuit until the Evers administration pulled out of it last year. The case hinges on a familiar point, the individual mandate. The court ruled in 2012 that it fell under Congress's power to levy taxes. But since then, the fine for not having health insurance has been reduced to zero, which left some justices questioning the legal standing of the new case. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act and how justices responded to the arguments in the case so far? Do you want to see the law stay in place? Do you think it should be struck down? If you're a Republican, do you think this is a battle the party should be fighting? If you're a Democrat, what do you want to see a new administration push for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amy Howe is co-founder of SCOTUS blog. She reports on the court there and at amylhowe.com. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
Well, I gave a super Cliff's Notes version there, Amy, of this this case. Can you tell us about what's at stake, the possible outcomes? It seems like there's three ranging from no change at all to the ACA is gone completely. What are some of the likely outcomes here?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different ways that this could go. So one is that the Supreme Court could say that the individual mandate and the defenders of the law don't like to call it the mandate because part of their argument is no one has to do anything now because there's no penalty if you don't get health insurance after Congress took away the penalty back in 2017 is constitutional, just like the Supreme Court said it was back in 2012, to the idea that the Supreme Court could say, well, we're not going to get to the merits of your challenge because the individuals who are challenging the mandate and then Texas and the group of, for lack of a better term, we'll call them red states who are challenging the mandate don't have what's known as standing, a legal right to sue. There's a scenario in which they could say the mandate is unconstitutional, but the rest of the Affordable Care Act can stay in place. And then there's the what Democratic senators, particularly during the Amy Coney Barrett hearings, sort of portrayed as the doomsday scenario in which a majority on the Supreme Court says the mandate is unconstitutional and the rest of the Affordable Care Act has to go with it.
And that's the argument.
All kinds of things that could happen.
That's the argument from plaintiffs and what they're hoping for, right? The idea that the mandate has to go and it's not severable from the rest of the Affordable Care Act. And at least one or two courts along the way agreed with them, right?
Exactly. So the Texas and the other states and the individual challengers went to federal court in Texas and a U.S. district judge there, Reed O'Connor, said, you're right. The mandate now is unconstitutional if there's no penalty for not having health insurance. Back in 2012, the Supreme Court said the mandate was constitutional because it was a tax. It can't be a tax anymore because it doesn't raise any money. So it's unconstitutional. And the rest of it has to go as well. So the federal government, the Trump administration, was not defending the mandate. California and a group of, for lack of a better term, I'll call them blue states, entered the case to defend the law along with the U.S. House of Representatives. They appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit took sort of a middle ground. They agreed with the challengers that the mandate is unconstitutional now, but they sent it back to Judge O'Connor and they said, can you take another look and see whether any parts of the law can still survive?
Talking to Amy Howe, longtime Supreme Court watcher, about oral arguments in a challenge to the Affordable Care Act before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. Okay, Amy, I've been told by a lot of people, I think probably including you somewhere along the way, you can't always tell what justices are thinking by the questions and concerns they raise in oral arguments. That said, can we tell what they're thinking based on what they had to say yesterday?
But you can. It is particularly difficult these days. Now, the Supreme Court, because of the pandemic, is holding oral arguments by telephone. And because it would be, you know, kind of a zoo, the Supreme Court's what's known as a hot bench. When they're in the courtroom, you can, you know, when you argue there, you can expect to have the questions flying sort of fast and furious. And if they were all on the phone and couldn't see each other and couldn't see the lawyer who was arguing, it would be kind of a hot mess. People would just be interrupting each other constantly. So what they are doing during the pandemic, they started this in May and have been continuing it ever since, is they take turns. They start with the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and then they move on in order of seniority. So they go on to Justice Clarence Thomas, who's been on the court the longest of any of the justices, Justice Stephen Breyer, and so on, all the way down to the court's newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett. And when everybody gets, you know, sort of a specific amount of time, it's harder to know what's on their mind. But having said that, you know, it did seem, I guess, that my takeaway after yesterday's oral argument, and again, it's risky to make predictions after oral argument. We saw that back in 2012 when everyone came away from the oral argument in the Obamacare case thinking that the Supreme Court was going to strike Obamacare down. And the Chief Justice dramatically joined the court's former liberal justices in upholding the mandate as a tax. Sort of the takeaway is that we're not quite sure exactly how they're going to do it, but it does seem like that even, you know, even if they say that the mandate is unconstitutional, the rest of the Affordable Care Act will survive.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Eli is with us in La Crosse. Eli, hi.
Hi. I just want to say, like, so I'm a pretty moderate conservative, and I voted Republican in the last election, but I think the Affordable Care Act should stay. I don't think that the mandate is okay. Why are we trying to penalize people who, for the most cases, can't afford insurance already? But as the rest of the law stands, I think that it's perfectly good that we keep it. Like, I'm 21. I'm lucky enough that I can stay on my parents' insurance till I'm 26. And if the ACA gets struck down, I have to wait an entire year for open enrollment to get insurance in my work.
Eli, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, the penalty under the mandate has gone away. Congress changed that. So, Amy, does the court, when they're looking at this, look at things like the impact this would have on Americans like Eli, or, you know, and what it would mean for the healthcare situation? Or are they really strictly looking at, you know, legislative intent and constitutional readings?
Well, it's an interesting question. And, you know, so on the one hand, they're looking at legal issues. But on the other hand, it's actually kind of hard to separate how it works in the real, in this particular case, how it works in the real world and experiences like Eli's from what they're trying to do, particularly when it comes to the question, if there are at least five of them who decide that the mandate is unconstitutional, what to do next. And this was something that we heard at oral argument a couple of times. You know, back in 2012, the federal government, then it was the Obama administration, said, you know, the mandate is an essential part of Obamacare, because the idea was, under Obamacare, insurance companies have to give insurance to everyone, even if they have pre-existing conditions. They have to do it at a reasonable price, even if you know, people have health problems. And to make this affordable for health insurance companies, they said, we're going to make everybody buy health insurance so that you'll have healthy people and sick people all together. And it turns out that since Congress took away the tax for failing to get health insurance, people are still buying it. And so Don Verrilli, who was the Solicitor General, the government's top lawyer back in 2012, defending the mandate, was actually back in court yesterday. And I'm putting in court in air quotes, because, of course, nobody is in the Supreme Court building right now because of the pandemic. And he said, look, you know, when Congress passed the mandate, they thought they needed it as a stick. And it turns out they don't. And so it is actually a case in which they do look at the real world impact, and they do look at what Congress intended.
Let's bring on another caller. Andrew is with us in Appleton. Andrew, hello.
Hi, I was just wondering, to what extent do you think the strike down of an individual mandate would mean to being a big blow to the Affordable Care Act? I know, as you've just mentioned, that it was really used as a necessary precaution as a portion of the healthcare law, but I want to know, to what extent will the Affordable Care Act still be workable, and how does this harm it in any way?
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. And as you were saying, Amy, that is one of the big questions here in this scenario that Andrew's describing, where the mandate, the penalty-less mandate gets struck down. It sounds like the argument it sounds like the case is being made that, yeah, it does survive. The rest of it does stand on its own without the mandate. Is that some of the argument we're hearing?
That's right. That's right. So, you know, when courts are trying to decide, like, if you, it's a quite, the legal doctrine is called severability. And when courts are trying to decide what to do, if you've got one provision that's unconstitutional, you know, what happens to the rest of it? The real question is, what would Congress have intended? And here the argument by the defenders of the mandate is, you know, well, clearly Congress took away the penalty for failing to get health insurance. So they left the rest of the law in place. They intended for the law to survive. And so, you know, I think as a legal matter, people think that that even if the mandate is unconstitutional, the rest of the Affordable Care Act will survive. And one of the things they point at, because the counter argument from the challengers is, no, you kept telling us back in 2012 that the metaphor was this three-legged stool. You had, you know, pre-existing conditions, you know, affordability and the mandate. And if you took out one of the legs, the whole thing would fall down, that Congress thought the mandate was essential. And it turns out, you know, the amendment to the Affordable Care Act that zeroed out the penalty for not getting health insurance was passed in 2017. It took effect at the beginning of 2019. So they've had almost 2 years where there isn't a penalty for not getting health insurance. And it seems like it's worked out okay.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Supreme Court reporter Amy Howe right now, looking at the arguments the court heard yesterday in a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Still time to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the ways that the justices talked about the Affordable Care Act, about what's at stake in this case? Do you have questions about the questions that the justices were asking along the way? How do you expect the court to rule? If you want to make a prediction, do you want to see the Affordable Care Act struck down all or in part? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog, where she writes about the Supreme Court. We're looking at yesterday's oral arguments about the Affordable Care Act and this ongoing challenge. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Amy, correct me if I'm wrong. It seems sometimes like at least some justices, and maybe Chief Justice Roberts in particular, I don't know, they don't want a whole lot of drama. They don't want to do a huge thing that overturns a big law passed by Congress. They might make the argument that if Congress wants to change the thing, they should change it. Is that a factor in anyone's thinking on the court here, do you think?
That's right. You know, some of your listeners may remember, it's been a while now, but back when the Chief Justice was at his own confirmation back in 2005, he, you know, tried to compare the role of a Supreme Court justice to being an umpire. We just call balls and strikes. We don't, you know, we don't play the game. And so there was a moment where he was talking to the lawyer for one of the challengers, and he said, you know, talking about this question of what happens if they decide the mandate is unconstitutional. And he said, you know, basically Congress only, you know, changed the penalty. They didn't repeal the whole law. They may have wanted the Supreme Court to strike down the whole law, but that's not our job. That's Congress's job. You know, I think he really regards it as being a positive thing for public perceptions as the Chief Justice. You know, he's concerned about public perceptions of the Supreme Court as a nonpartisan institution. And I think he feels like in a case like this, sort of the less done, the better in many ways.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Glenn is with us in Green Bay. Glenn, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up?
Well, my question was, you know, the economy has been better over the last, I don't know, a couple of years. And I know that the mandate, you had said that the mandate turns out maybe we don't need it. My question is, if we're into a recession and let's say the economy is poor and more people are out of work, would that then strain the system and make the mandate more necessary?
Oh, interesting, Glenn. Thanks for the call. Amy, is that something that either side was bringing up that, you know, maybe the years or I guess almost 2 years now that it's worked without the mandate might not represent future performance?
That's an interesting question. I can't recall seeing it, but it's certainly something, you know, I think there are, you know, there are other mechanisms in place as part of the Affordable Care Act. You know, there are subsidies to help people who can't afford to buy health insurance, on the other hand, and that was one of the arguments that the state made in terms of why it had a right to sue, was that as a result of the mandate, then the, you know, it had more people signing up for Medicaid than otherwise would have. So, you know, I guess it could work both ways.
Thanks for the call, Glenn, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Amy Howe about the U.S. Supreme Court oral arguments yesterday on a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Okay, Amy, you said one possible outcome is that the court decides, yeah, the plaintiffs here don't have standing, so there's no case to be had. That would mean they're not ruling on the merits of the case at all, which means what? I guess some plaintiffs somewhere could just start the whole thing over again?
Theoretically, I think the question would be who those plaintiffs would be. You know, the individual plaintiffs in this case had argued that they had a right to sue because they felt like they were compelled to buy health insurance, but they didn't want to. And so, you know, I'm not quite sure who would be an individual plaintiff who could bring a lawsuit if these plaintiffs couldn't. There, you know, there's some discussion about the states, you know, perhaps they might theoretically have a right to sue, but they hadn't presented enough evidence. You know, another sort of data point to keep in mind would be that if the Supreme Court said that these particular plaintiffs didn't have a right to sue and threw out the lawsuit, you know, somebody could file a lawsuit later, you know, it could come back to court. It would be, in all likelihood by then, assuming that things, you know, that a Biden administration in the Justice Department rather than a Trump administration, and the Biden administration presumably would opt to defend the law, unlike the Trump administration. I'm not sure that it would necessarily make a difference in the outcome of the case if it got to the Supreme Court, but it certainly would, with the dynamics of the lawsuit might be different.
Thanks for calling in, Glenn. Now, Amy, the severability argument, you, I think, wrote that some of the arguments were hinging on the precedent it would set if the Supreme Court agreed that if you get rid of the mandate, the whole thing has to go. The whole law is not severable. It doesn't survive without the mandate. Concerns that if you start applying that to any bill Congress might pass, like a big omnibus spending bill, for example, concerns that that could lead to a lot of chaos. What were some of the arguments there?
So this was actually with regard to standing.
Well, that was a standing. I'm sorry.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, so the individual plaintiffs said they had standing because they had to buy health insurance. They didn't want to. The state said, well, we've got paperwork. We've got people signing up for Medicaid. The federal government had this theory about why the challengers had a legal right to sue that involved, you know, that they would be injured by a different provision in the Affordable Care Act that would be invalidated if the mandate were deemed unconstitutional and the whole ACA were struck down. And Justice Elena Kagan was a little bit incredulous. You know, her reaction was basically, are you kidding me? She said, you know, the government is usually trying to keep people out of court. And here you've got this really expansive view and that would really expand who could come into court. Because, as you say, sometimes we've got these massive omnibus laws that address all kinds of different things. And somebody could come into court and say, well, you know, I think that I think that that provision is unconstitutional and it doesn't injure me, but it would, if the whole law was struck down, it would invalidate this provision, which does injure me.
Got it. Thanks for setting me straight on that. Now, Amy, does the court give us any indication on when they might rule on this case?
No, and I think a lot depends on exactly how they rule on it. If they were to decide, for example, that the challengers didn't have standing, that they didn't have a right to sue, that might be something that, you know, we wouldn't certainly be getting it in the next couple of weeks, but we might get sooner rather than, you know, one of these late June decisions that we've become accustomed to. You know, sort of the more steps they take, you know, if they were to decide that the challengers do have standing, the mandate is unconstitutional, but then, you know, nonetheless, the rest of the Affordable Care Act can survive. There's a lot of moving parts and there's going to be a lot of disagreement among the justices, you know, multiple, you know, concurring and dissenting opinions there. And that could take a while.
And just briefly, Amy, I think a lot of people might have assumed a 6-3 conservative majority would doom the Affordable Care Act, whether they were happy about that or not. It's we don't know the outcome, but it just sounds like it's not necessarily so.
I think that's right. You know, I think, you know, we do think of, you know, the sort of the conventional wisdom in the public is that sort of the court's a 6-3 conservative majority. Therefore, they're going to vote to strike down the Affordable Care Act. You know, certainly that was the picture that Democratic senators tried to paint during the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. You know, I will say it is not, it is pretty much what I think sort of the legal experts had expected all along. Going into the Supreme Court term, lots of sort of law schools and institutions will do these previews where they look ahead at the Supreme Court term. And in the discussions of the cases, people, you know, didn't necessarily think that the Affordable Care Act was doomed. There was one comment that wound up being quoted a lot at Georgetown University Law School, my alma mater, the former Solicitor General Paul Clement, who actually challenged the Affordable Care Act back in 2012, you know, said, I think it's going to be a real uphill struggle to invalidate the whole Affordable Care Act. And it looks like he may well be right.
Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
That's Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog. Read her work at amylhowe.com. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 2020 has been a busy year for the Wisconsin National Guard. On this Veterans Day, we'll talk with a spokesperson about what they've been up to with testing for COVID-19, helping with elections and protests, and more. Now, according to the National Retail Foundation, people are expected to spend nearly $1,000 on holiday gifts this year on average. That's slightly less than last year. And because of COVID-19, most consumers plan to do at least some, maybe even all, of their shopping online. The Better Business Bureau is urging people to do their homework before heading to the Cyber Mall, and they say we should be especially vigilant of scams. Jim Temer is the CEO and president of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Rob.
All right. Well, thinking back to pre-pandemic times, Jim, how much did we have to worry about online scams? We had them before COVID for sure.
That's right. But and actually, for the 3 years before 2020, so well before COVID, online scams like this were in the top three every single year for the past 3 years and growing because more and more people were just going, as you said, to the Cyber Mall. And now after stores were shut down, people don't want to leave their homes. They're finding, hey, I can sit home and it's pretty easy to shop online. The amount of holiday scams, shopping scams are really through the roof. We've seen over a 300% increase in consumers looking to examine online retailers to see if they're legitimate or not. So at least people are starting to do that homework.
All right. If I'm looking at a website, I see what looks like a pretty good deal. How do I assess whether it's a legitimate business if it's not something I've heard of before?
Well, first of all, if that deal looks too good to be true, as cliche as it sounds, it probably is. Scammers rely on price and price alone. And it starts with, believe it or not, how you search. Say you want to buy an Aaron Rodgers Green Bay Packer jersey for your nephew for a holiday. And you see they're usually $150. And then you go into Google and you type in cheap football jersey or discount football jersey. The ads that come up, some of those more than likely will be scams. But then I guarantee you, once you open your Facebook or your social media, the things that you're going to scroll through then for Aaron Rodgers football jerseys probably are scams. And the platforms that reported the most consumers who lost money, Facebook was number one, Google was number two, and then direct merchant websites and Instagram and pop-ups after that. So it's really out there all over the place. And what you can do, first of all, you can beware of those fake websites. Check the URL. Sometimes they spell them a little differently. Walmart will have two L's instead of one, or they'll put a number in there somewhere, or it's just slightly different. But they take professional photos off of legitimate websites of real items, and they put them on theirs. You can also check out that URL address. There should be an S. It should start with an HTTPS, and that S means it's secure. And you can put your personal information, your credit card in there, or there might be a little padlock up in the address line as well. Those are just a few things to look for. Another one is you can do some research on the website. A lot of times scammers will put these sites up. They're there for a couple of weeks, a couple of months. It comes down, they start another one. Is there a return policy? Is there an about us section? Does it talk about consumer protection plans in there? Does it talk about where we are located? You can Google their address and see if it's a real place or not, or is it the middle of a cornfield? So do your homework ahead of time. And really don't make those snap decisions based only on price when you're scrolling through your social media.
All right. Suppose we already bought that thing and it never came. Doesn't seem like there's any way to get redress for that. What should we do when we know our money has been charged and we're not getting something from them?
Well, depending on the type of payment you made, you might be out of luck. The other thing we recommend always is use a credit card when you're shopping online. Don't send any kind of online wire transfers. Some debit cards are not protected with the same security and same protections you get when using a credit card. That's one of the reasons you're paying, 18-19%, whatever it is, on credit cards, because that's built in. So if you order something and it never comes, or it's a cheap knockoff imitation, you got scammed, you contact your credit card company and hopefully they'll refund that money. Also, you can report that, report it to BBB.org. We've got a thing called Scam Tracker. It's an interactive heat map. It shows scams going on across all of North America. We compile all that information and we share it with law enforcement. I'd like to say that we have luck prosecuting some of these scammers, but most of them are overseas. And like I said, these URLs come up, the website comes up, a few weeks later it comes down, and they have another one with a different name. So it's really difficult to find them. So that's why we're getting your listeners to think before they buy, and hopefully they're not left not even holding the bag and just out their money with nothing on the back end.
Talking to Jim Temer from the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin, looking at holiday shopping scams and how to avoid them. Okay, Jim, suppose we buy something, they deliver the goods, but you're like, wait a minute, Aaron Rodgers' number isn't 97. If you get fraudulent goods or something other than promised, is there a recourse there?
Well, same thing. If you have a credit card, you definitely can dispute the charges, and hopefully they won't charge your credit card or you'll get your money back. And also, maybe it is a legitimate a website. That's what I mean. Check ahead of time and see if they have return policies, what it is. If it's through Amazon, they have certain things. If it's Facebook Marketplace, whatever it is. But if you know that ahead of time and then you get it and you're unhappy with it for any reason, or maybe it's broke, you order something and it comes and it's broken, you're going to have to return that. So make sure you know those policies ahead of time. But if you don't know the policies and you go back to the website and it's not there, or they don't have a phone number for a contact us, those are all red flags. And if it's going to cost you a little more money to go with a legitimate website, please do so. The other thing we are really promoting for people is, even though we're all shopping online, remember those local businesses in your towns or that are near you. You might not be visiting them over the holidays, but gosh, support them. If you can buy a gift card for a local business that you can give to somebody, or for a service, a class or a restaurant, we still have to support those local businesses all we can.
Well, and there's a reliability factor there too. We know their address. We know the place. We may have a track record with them. And I'm guessing more and more, or I know more and more stores and restaurants are finding ways to still do their business in hopefully in mostly COVID safe ways. So there is that reliability element of the store that's been there 20, 50 years versus the website I just found just now.
You bet. And, you know, you can use the internet to help those small businesses, too, or those local businesses that are going to be there. You want them to be there after COVID and do things that don't cost money. You know, give them a 5-star review, like and share their stuff they put on social media. So we can help them by buying things. We can help them by promoting their business as well. And that's not to say pay an extra, 50% for something local. We all have our own decisions to make. But just keep it in mind and maybe, like you say, give an extra nod to those small businesses that are always going to be there for us, we hope, and that we know do things the right way.
And Jim, as we wrap up, a closing message for listeners when it comes to shopping safely?
Boy, do your homework ahead of time. And again, this time of year especially, stick to a budget. Create that budget. Know what it is. No one's going to love you anymore if you go over your budget. So stick to it. So in January, you weren't pounding your head.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Jim Temer is CEO and president of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. We talked to them about how to shop safely online, shop wisely too during the holiday season. You can review these tips and learn more. By the way, we've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story in honor of today's Veterans Day holiday.
When the United States declared war on Germany in 1917, millions of young men across the country enlisted to serve in what they believed would be the war to end all wars. One of those men was 21-year-old J. Vincent Hood of Racine, Wisconsin. His great-grandson, Mark Sullivan, interviewed him about World War I nearly 80 years later. Mark brings us this story just ahead of Veterans Day.
Johnny, get your gun. Take it on the run.
For 4 years, the Germans and the French had fought a war. Trench wars, they call them.
That's the voice of Vincent Hood, lifelong resident of Racine, Wisconsin, combat veteran of the First World War, and my great-grandfather. In less than a year's time, Vincent went from selling real estate in Racine to the horrors of the Western Front. When the 32nd Division first arrived in Europe, they were confined to the trenches, fighting alongside the famed 10th French Army.
Say the French drove the Germans back to their trench, but then they quit. And the Germans, in the meantime, got to build up their army again, and then they drove the French back to their trench. And they build up again. And that way it went on for 4 years.
I remember my grandfather talking about the war, about pulling great big guns across the front on horse-drawn carts, or the time he got caught up in clouds of mustard gas, his fingers pruned and skin yellowed for days. He told me about the trenches, about the mud, the muck, the smell. Commander of U.S. Forces General John J. Pershing quickly lost patience with the stalemate of trench warfare and opted to go on the attack. What followed was a series of battles known as the Hundred Days Offensive.
So when the Americans came in, they didn't want to. No trench warfare. The only way you're going to end this thing is not allow any trench. Keep them off guard. Keep hitting them all the time. They can't get set. And we were not allowed to go into any trenches.
Vincent and the 32nd Division forged ahead, leading four major campaigns and fighting in two more, never once ceding ground to the German army. It was here that they earned the nickname Les Terribles, the Terrible Ones. In September of 1918, the 32nd became the first Allied division to break through the famed Hindenburg Line, a 50-mile-long, 3.5-mile-deep network of fortified German defenses. The end of the war seemed near.
When the Germans saw that, the French army, he said, "Fini la guerre," that means the end of the war. He realized what a difference it was if we couldn't fight in trenches.
The American punch counted. War-weary Germans surrendered in droves. The end was near at hand. Finally, on that unforgettable November the 11th, the Blessed Army came to the trenches.
After the war, Vincent returned home to Racine and to his wife, Marion. Together, they raised four children and dozens of grand and great-grandchildren before Vincent passed away in 1997 at the age of 101. As we commemorate a full century since the armistice, I can't help but consider the life of Vincent Hood, a man who came in with the carriage and left with the space shuttle, a life that spanned from Grover Cleveland to Bill Clinton. 100 years feels like ancient history, but my relationship with my great-grandfather is proof that our history is still here with us today, as more than just ghosts and memories. Our past is our present. And so as we honor all veterans on November 11th, let's not forget the first to experience the horrors of modern warfare. Those soldiers came home victorious, raised their families through the Great Depression, and then sent their sons off to avenge Pearl Harbor and beat back the Nazi menace. If the citizens and soldiers who defeated Hitler and Hirohito are the greatest generation, then what do we call Vincent's generation?
Mark Sullivan studies audio engineering in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll check in with the Wisconsin National Guard about the many things that have kept them busy in 2020, including a big role in COVID-19 testing. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Pfizer's vaccine announcement has been met with cautious excitement, but there's still a lot we don't know yet. Jen White finds out what we do know and gets your questions answered. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, today is Veterans Day in the U.S., a time for honoring those who serve or have served in the armed forces. For the Wisconsin National Guard, it's been a pretty busy year. Members have been performing a variety of roles in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, including collecting tests. In fact, last week they collected a record 55,000 specimens in more than 40 counties. That brought the total number of samples taken from around the state to more than 800,000. Guard members also served as poll workers during the April, May, August, and November elections, and they are activated to assist law enforcement with protests in Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Racine, Kenosha, and Wauwatosa over the summer. That's on top of their ordinary training schedules and workload throughout the year. Major Joe Travato is spokesperson for the Wisconsin National Guard. Major Travato, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, and happy Veterans Day.
And to you, too. And wow, just saying everything on top of your normal duties. This has been a busy year for the National Guard here in the state.
It has. And actually, in the spirit of Veterans Day, I'd point out, too, that since Veterans Day 2019, the Wisconsin National Guard has either deployed or returned from deployment some 1,200 troops from places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, the Middle East, the Horn of Africa, Ukraine. So we've been very busy on our federal overseas missions, in addition to all the litany of missions you just listed off here at home as well.
How do you train people for something like that? You could be working at a polling site or taking COVID samples, or you could be deployed literally to a war zone.
You know, we pride ourselves on our adaptability, our flexibility. You know, we're citizen soldiers and citizen airmen who come from so many different diverse backgrounds and skill sets from all across Wisconsin. And, you know, really, all those diverse backgrounds are really what make us well-suited to take on either, you know, the vast array of domestic missions we could be involved with here in the state, but also professionally perform our overseas mission as well. So it's definitely a lot of training, but our soldiers and airmen are so versatile and so professional, and we're just incredibly proud of what they've been able to do this past year.
Now, you mentioned what was going on in some of those international deployments. Let's talk more about the COVID testing here at home. Can you talk about the role that Guard members have played this in this rough year when it comes to this disease?
Yeah, absolutely. So we first mobilized troops all the way back on March 12th. And that was really when the state of emergency was declared at the state level for the COVID-19 pandemic response. And that initial mission was actually to bring back some cruise ship passengers who had been exposed potentially to COVID. There were about 35, I believe, Wisconsin residents who were aboard this cruise ship that docked in California. And National Guard members were called up to actually help transport those individuals back to their homes safely. And ever since then, the role has just continued to grow. We've had, at a peak, we had 1,400 Wisconsin Guard members who were mobilized in support of the pandemic response. And we've taken on a variety of different roles. The biggest one being, and the most enduring one, the probably what most people are familiar with, the community testing sites, the COVID-19 testing sites that are have pretty much now had been in almost every Wisconsin county since widespread testing began. But we also have performed a number of other roles, ranging from assisting with the Dane County Medical Examiner's Office. We've sent some individuals to assist at some of the isolation facilities when those were in operation. We helped establish in the initial days of the alternate care facility. We helped kind of do some warehousing for them. And we've also operated a call center, and that mission continues. We've placed more than 515,000 calls to residents who are awaiting their COVID-19 testing results. So it's been an incredible year, and certainly we expect it to continue for a while.
Also related to COVID, at election season, a lot of the most common volunteers at polling sites are unfortunately seniors who were more vulnerable to COVID. Can you talk about how the National Guard stepped in there?
Yeah, absolutely. That was another mission where, you know, we were ready, we were willing, and you know, there are Guard members, because we are citizen soldiers and airmen, we live and work in all the same communities all across Wisconsin. So, you know, Wisconsin has a election law in the book that says that, generally speaking, poll workers are supposed to be working as poll workers in the community, or in the county at least, in which they reside. And then there's another law that says that state employees can serve as poll workers as well. So when we get mobilized to state active duty, we essentially become Wisconsin state employees at that point. And since we had Guard members spread all across the state to begin with, they were literally neighbors helping neighbors, serving in their very own communities in most cases. And we were just in a good, fortunate position to be able to assist our state in that time of need.
Now, Major Trovato, National Guard members are employed here in Wisconsin, or maybe going to a college of some sort or another. Do you have thoughts for employers or maybe professors on how to work around an unpredictable schedule for members of the National Guard?
Well, we talk often in the National Guard about the three-legged stool that supports the Guard member. One, of course, is our families. That's the backbone of the support network that our soldiers and airmen need. But the other two are understanding and support of communities and employers. And certainly colleges fit within that realm. And of course, employers who oftentimes are letting their Guard member employees go away for even their weekend drill training or their regularly scheduled military professional education courses, not to mention the potential for deployment overseas, or as we've talked about in 2020, certainly a lot of deployment here in the state of Wisconsin as well. So we can't thank our employers, our families, our communities, our colleges, university system enough. There's no way we could do what we do without their continued understanding and support.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Major Trovato, what do you want people to know most about the state's National Guard and its members?
Well, you know, we're just very proud to serve our state, our nation, and our communities. Most of us, we wear this uniform because we want to assist our state and our nation in a time of need. So while pandemic response may be something that's kind of new for us, or serving as a poll worker at an election may not be what some of us originally anticipated we might be doing when we first took the oath and swore to defend our nation. But what is very much our core mission is to be there for when our state needs us, or when our community needs us, and when our country needs us. That's why we wear the uniform, and we're honored to be of assistance anytime that our state calls on us.
Major Trovato, thanks for joining us on this Veterans Day.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Major Joe Travato is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin National Guard. We talked to him about a busy year for the Guard in Wisconsin in 2020.